Welcome to the Sociology and Animals podcast. My name is Dr. Corey Wren. I'm a lecturer in sociology with the University of Kent in beautiful, stunning Canterbury, England. I'm also the co-founder, along with Zoe Sutton, of the International Association for Vegan Sociologists. And this is our podcast where we interview emerging and established scholars in the field of critical animal studies. But more specifically, we're looking at sociologists. So you aren't going to get this anywhere else. We're specifically picking out sociological thinkers and sociological theory to unpack the very troubled relationship between humans and other animals. In this episode today, we are speaking with Dr. Bonnie Berry, who's been a longtime member of the ASA Animals and Society group, also works with an institute researching social problems. And so Bonnie is one of those folks who's been around for a long time and has a lot of really good critical hindsight and institutional history about the study of non-human animals from a sociological point of view. So very, very cool we were able to get her on. She's using a landline, hence the audio is not as good as it could be. I tried to fix it as best as I can with my limited technical skills, but there you have it. Before we get started, just a quick reminder, please remember to share this episode and other episodes on Twitter, Facebook, etc. This is really how we get most of our traffic, so be sure to also promote it to your students, or if you are a student, to your colleagues, other students. Maybe one day we'll get some funding. I think the University of Kent is teasing me with some funding for podcast platforming, but really we rely on sociologists to make good on this podcast and spread it with other folks. So yeah, as you probably know, we don't have many dedicated sociological spaces for the study of non-human animals. So yeah, help us out. Also, if you are a student and you're thinking about graduate studies, you might consider beautiful University of Kent. Come here and study sociology and veganism and animal rights with me. If you want more information about that, shoot me an email. My contact information will be at the end of this episode. Also, don't forget that each year, the International Association for Vegan Sociologists, we hold a conference, which is very student-friendly and activist-friendly. If you are applying sociological theory, then come along, either to present or as an audience member. And yes, we hold this every year. In 2021, it's going to be in October, virtually, of course. We're still in the age of COVID. All right, let's rock and roll and see what we can learn from Dr. Berry in this episode. Hi, Bonnie. Welcome. And thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed on the Sociology and Animals podcast. What a thrill and an honor to track you down and get you here. So why don't you introduce yourself? You. Tell us about your amazing, special, delightful self.
Thank you, Corey. It's great to hear from you. I'm a sociologist. I have a PhD in sociology, and I study, and have always studied throughout my career, social inequality, and hence my interest in power stratification, rights and denial of rights. The forms of inequality I've studied throughout my career include the usually considered forms, such as gender inequality, disability, criminality, socioeconomic status, race, age, nationality, and sexual orientation. Mm. But I've also studied less usually considered forms of inequality, such as appearance bias, which is bias against and for humans based on their physical appearance. And that doesn't just mean attractiveness, it means, you know, height and any feature that humans have. Mm. And of course, they experience bias depending on what they look like. And I also have a question, the denial of rights to non-human animals, which certainly follows.
So tell us about you've just recently come out with a book, haven't you? Or I can't remember if it's recently or not, on this lookism, I guess.
Yeah, I have. It's the third book I've written on appearance bias, and this one particularly pertains to bias against criminal suspects, people who get caught up in the criminal justice system, all the way to the death penalty. Mm. And it very definitely, appearance bias definitely affects how people are responded to by not just the police, but also by the public who report to the police that there's a black person in my neighborhood and we don't have any black people here. So it definitely affects what happens from the point of suspicion to the death penalty.
So I'm going to ask you to like flesh that out a little bit more. And then, of course, I'm going to ask you how that relates to non-human animals. But for, I guess, for the classically trained sociologists, we get the major isms like racism, sexism, and classism. But this appearance bias is kind of usually subsumed within that. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about what makes that unique from the classic isms and why it's important for us to know about that difference.
Actually, this is a good question, and I've been thinking a lot about this. The more I've studied isms, and the more I've studied isms, the more I've noticed that there is very little difference between how we view humans with disadvantaged characteristics, such as appearance disadvantages, and race, and orientation, and so on. There's very little difference between how we can study that human isms to species isms. For example, and this is something that I've been thinking a good deal about lately. In sociology and legal studies, we think of people who are disadvantaged as the other, such as black people are often considered the other, Asians and so on are considered the other, including women. And we can also consider non-human animals as the other. Now, if we can view any beings, animals and humans, as the other, we can treat them any way we want to because they aren't like us. We can mistreat them, we can use them, we can exploit them. But if we don't see them as the other, if we take a more inclusive approach, then they we can't treat them as badly as we would if we see them as the other. Let me just define that a little better. People here, well, maybe in all societies, talk about the other, but I'm specifically focusing on something even more fundamental than that, called difference, the concept of difference. Just because somebody is different from another person, lesbian or straight, doesn't mean that there's anything defective about that person. Or if somebody has really kinky hair, it doesn't mean that they're defective. Somebody's disabled doesn't mean that they're defective compared to other people. It means that there's a difference. Disability is a difference, but it's merely that, a difference.
So I wonder, like listening to this and thinking about how it might apply to other animals, I was just thinking with, when we talk about, like, say, a cisgendered system or a white-centered system, there are people who are of color who might be white passing and they would avoid a lot of that appearance bias. Or someone who's trans and quote-unquote passes, they might avoid some of that appearance bias. So then when it comes to looking at non-human animals, obviously non-human animals are dealing with the structural discrimination of speciesism, but then based on looks, they may have more or less privileges. But would in this case, Bonnie, would we say like a gorilla or a chimpanzee or a monkey would have less of that bias? Or would we say actually more of the cuter animals or dogs or cats would have less of that bias?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I proposed to the Animal Society section that there may be, and we don't have any empirical data on this, but there may be discrimination across species, such as deer. Everybody thinks deer are pretty. People think that elk are not pretty. So we do have some discrimination across species as applied by humans. But I wonder if there is discrimination within species. That's an attractive deer. That's an unattractive deer. And how do deer respond to, say, a deer who looks different, is unattractive, or maybe crippled. Of course, they wouldn't survive very well if they were differently abled. But there may be bias within the animal queendom against animals, depending on what they look like.
Yeah, I think we had a little bit of a chat earlier last month about albino deer. And they look, they stand out, don't they? And obviously that would be a disadvantage to them because they're not as camouflaged. But you were mentioning that, well, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, that they're, you know, more lovely, people are more attuned to them. But I used to work in a state park in Virginia, and the ranger told us that there's a whole bunch of them. And he said it's because they're stuck in this park and they're inbred and they don't allow hunting. Of course, that was an awful ad there. But he was using that as a justification to allow hunting in the state park. It was because of the albino deer. So that actually flagged them. And the other thing is looking at pigeons. I saw today a pure white pigeon, which looks, I mean, pigeons are doves. They're a branch of the dove family, right? And people grimace at the pigeons and call them rats and all this nasty stuff. Poor rats also. But then when you see this beautiful white pigeon that looks like a dove, which is closely related anyway, and you can just see how that fluke, genetic fluke, changes people's perception about the same animal.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that that's probably very likely to be true. And, you know, speaking of passing, one thing that I've made crystal clear in the work I've done about human appearance is it is strongly discouraged to change your appearance only to make yourself acceptable to, say, white. Asians get their eyes rounded. That's the most common cosmetic surgery because they want to look more like white and be accepted by whites. Blacks who have their noses altered or their lips altered or straighten their hair and so on. You know, I get it. You know, they need to do that in order to have certain advantages in life, like to get a job or to be admitted to a social club or to get a good education. I get it, you know, why they would do that. But I would never encourage somebody to look more white because they want to be accepted.
Right, it gets down to that bit. Sorry, I was just getting down to the bit you said earlier about the difference not being, you know, nothing defective. It's just difference.
Exactly. Yeah, and you mentioned, I think you mentioned my work on animal appearance, and I have that one article I published in Society and Animals, and humans will alter their, as in possessive, animals' physical traits in order to make themselves, the humans, seem special or different or powerful or, you know, something good.
Give an example of that.
Oh, for example, this is pretty awful, but I was going to give you an example about soaring of horses' legs, which is, you know, horrible, very painful surgery. But, you know, people who train horses and want to show them off will do that.
They do what? Sorry?
Soaring, I think it's S-O-R-I-N-G, and it's they cut a tendon in the horse's leg. It makes, when the horses walk, they lift up their legs, and it's supposed to be, I don't know, interesting or attractive or something. But this is a better example. People will have cosmetically inserted into their animal's scrotum nuticles. It's called nuticles. N-E-U-T-I-C-L-E, yes, I think. Anyway, it makes the animal look like he still has his sexual organs intact. And mainly this is something that men do to their dogs. But anyway, it's a cosmetic procedure to make them look like they're still intact when they're not.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's a weird area, I gotta tell you.
Well, then even in there are just so many different ways. I can see how this is an endless amount of ideas for research, but then just thinking about with the dog example, you know, obviously dogs who don't look a certain way are less likely to be adopted. And I mean, I have a proud mutt, a street dog here from Bulgaria. And she's got all kinds of quote unquote defects. She's got extra toes on top of her toes, toenails, like dead toenails growing out of the dead toes. She's intersex as well. She's just got all kinds of weird genetic stuff going on with her. Not that intersex is weird, it's a totally natural thing, but obviously something went wrong with her. She's also deaf and all this sort of stuff. But I think in her case, it was like the albino deer or the albino pigeon. I was like, oh, that dog is different. I want that dog. But for a lot of people, you can, you know, is the case. They're like, oh, this street dog, what breed is that? And I get that all the time with people. What breed is that? It's like, she's just a dog. It's just a dog and just a cute dog. But then I know there's also research that shows that, say, black dogs and black cats are less likely to be adopted for various reasons, as simple as they're harder to photograph and it's hard to get a good picture to put on social media to promote them. Or in my case, I have a black cat, and when I went in to adopt, I said, give me the cat nobody wants because I don't want to choose. Just give me the one nobody wants. So they gave me her.
Oh, yeah.
And they said that black cats are so hard to adopt because people are so superstitious. And that's when I was living in New Jersey, which I wouldn't think would be that superstitious about black cats. But that is another excellent example of how just the chances of what the color of your hair is going to be, and that's going to determine your life outcome.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
So let's get to the sociological element of this then, Bonnie. The tricky question is, I asked you to come to the podcast to talk about social problems, and we've been talking about a lot of them. So where do you think, this is a hard question, where do you think all this comes from? Where does this stem from? Where are these social problems emerging from?
You mean speciesism and racism and
all
that?
Of it, any of it, yeah. So there's various theories on where this stuff comes from. Like what speaks to you?
I think, especially observing the United States society lately, things are looking better now, but lately, and this has always been true for the United States society, but we had a very rough 4 or 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
People want to feel not just superior to other beings, which could be other humans or to animals. They want to feel superior, but it also gives them a great deal of convenience. If people want to eat steaks and pork chops, you know, they feel that they should, and they don't want to be told, you know, that animals are hurt doing this. Do you realize it's ruining the environment to do this? Mm. They don't want to think about that. And I think that it sustains their power, the advantaged person's power, if they can continue to oppress other categories of beings.
Mm. What would you say about the argument? This is why I ask her, what do you think? Because there's lots of different arguments about where this even comes from. But some might say this emerges from, say, the Marxist perspective. It emerges from our economic mode of production, perhaps exacerbated by capitalism. And obviously, speciesism has been around for much longer than capitalism. But it seems like, at least with racism and classism, those are extremely, and speciesism, extremely aggravated by the move to the capitalist system. Does that speak to you at all?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yes. When we think about non-human animals, people like you and me, we think about non-human animals, they are commodities. Mm. And that's unfortunate and unfair and, you know, ridiculous, but most people see them as commodities. Cows and pigs and chickens and so on are there to be eaten, and animals are there to entertain us in horse races and dog races. And we can make money off of those things. Now, here's kind of a hopeful thing, though. Lately, in the United States and elsewhere, we have some new alternatives for food. And, of course, the meat industry, being a capitalist industry, is not at all happy about that. But we do have a lot of really wonderful new choices. And, you know, people would say to me, oh, I'd like to be a vegetarian, but I think tofu tastes like foam rubber, so I don't want to eat tofu. But we have some choices now that are, well, they taste like meat, let me put it that way. Mm. And people like that taste for whatever reason. So we do have some good choices now. I think we are evolving slowly, way too slowly.
Yeah. I'm here to vouch for tofu. I actually just caught myself. I ate half a tub. I just eat it straight out of the tub, Bonnie. I can't even be bothered to cook it.
Oh, I like it. I like tofu.
Yeah. It's like, we're the old school vegans. Like, I remember back when we didn't have all these convenience items. Yeah. Let me ask you. So we've talked a little bit about how, you know, options have changed. But what about within academia, in your neck of the woods, have you've seen more opportunities or resistance when it comes to incorporating non-human topics and interests into your work?
More opportunities.
Yeah.
I see this as a very good thing. Huh. For example, the American Sociological Association has like a lot of different sections, and that list of sections grows and grows, and it should have happened earlier, but it didn't. But now it's happening that we have an animals society section, we have environmental sections, and we have all manner of sections. And what's really cool, this is a very cool development, we have a crossover between and among, say, speciesism, environmentalism, yeah. and racism.
Yeah.
Our own section, the Animals and Society works, has a workshop on taking action against human racism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly, somebody is recognizing that racism is not different from speciesism. I think that's a very good development.
Yeah, absolutely. But you haven't run into any barriers, because you work for a research institution, don't you?
Well, I'm the director of social promise research.
Right. So you kind of, I guess, well, if you're in charge, then it's easy to make. But when you're really collaborating with other entities, institutions, do you not run up against kind of barriers, or are people a lot more open-minded to you?
I think people are more open-minded to me. I don't get a lot of barriers. And one thing I've noticed, I think conversation is a much underrated means of propelling society forward.
Mm.
And I don't really mention, right out front that I'm animal rights advocate, because, as I'm sure it kind of, ticks people off. They don't want to hear about it because they want to keep living their life like they do, eating, wearing animals, and so on. So I don't usually mention it, but every now and then I'll get, for example, somebody will say, they find out I'm an animal rights advocate, and they'll say, oh, so you don't like human beings. Ha, ha, ha. It's supposed to be funny, that animal rights people don't like humans. And I say, well, actually, no, it's not like that. There's documented evidence backed up by numbers that people who support animal rights are also very much supportive of human rights.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But that is one way of injecting a little bit of information. And if they're intrigued, we can go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. The evidence is certainly on our side, and we're increasingly having that evidence. I know I did a survey of American vegans back in 2017, and the rate of intersectional awareness and activism was really, really high. And then also, I'm a member of a social psychology research group at my university that specializes in speciesism, and they repeatedly find this correlation between the two. So absolutely. So Bonnie, I guess I want to get towards the end now, and I want to ask you now for some recommendations. And this is not an easy question to answer, so you may fudge it if you have more than one. But if you had to choose one study or one book or one article that really sums up what you think is important about vegan sociology, critical animal studies, or specifically what you specialize in, what would you recommend?
I would recommend David Nyberg's 2017 book called Animal Oppression and Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It covers the range. So that would be, if I had to say, one choice, this would be it.
Do you know what? I might agree with you, but I might pick the 2002 one.
Oh yeah, I've got that on. I've got that in my notes.
They're both really excellent. amazing. Yes. Ah, okay. Well, what if people are just like, wow, I want to learn more about appearance bias or just really social problems as they relate to speciesism? Where might you direct folks, besides the ASA, which you've very courteously shouted out? Your own institute, maybe?
Actually, I know not the Social Problems Research Group. And I guess I would just say, besides Dave Nyberg's book, there's another book that's out now, Elizabeth Cherry's new book, For the Birds.
Uh-huh.
And here, the reason I'm bringing this up is it's a book about bird watching as a conservation hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool about it is that this kind of study is more significant than you might think at first glance, because it addresses the whole picture of non-human animals, birds in this case, humans observing these birds, and the environment in which these birds and these humans live. So you have a nice confluence of factors, and also in terms of inclusion, and I think that this is one of the things I've been kind of thinking more about lately. There's a professor of wildlife biology up here at the University of Washington who involves ordinary people, as he calls citizen scientists, to observe animals, mainly crows. And I think if people are involved in looking at animals, as Luke Sherry suggests or John Marsloff suggests, it equalizes the humans and the non-humans. Mm. It's like, oh, these birds feel like, you know, they're hungry too, and they need something to drink, and they need a good, clean environment, like I do.
Mm-hmm. I can also vouch for that book. It won last year's ASA Animals and Society section best book. So there you go. Another excellent choice. All right. So now my last question is also a tricky one, and it'll put you on the spot. But do the best you can. If you could, please, in one sentence, maybe two, what does vegan sociology mean to you, Bonnie?
Oh, I don't know. That is kind of a tricky question. I mean,
but I think you're in a good position to give a definition here, because you and I, having worked together through the Animals and Society section, we've run up against a little bit of resistance, I'd say, from our own section, because not everybody in the section is vegan or even vegan positive. And we've also run up with resistance from the ASA itself, because we had originally written a piece. We wanted to put, it went in footnotes, the one that we did. We did one for footnotes. But I'd also petitioned Context. When COVID happened, Context put out a call. And for people who aren't familiar, footnotes and Context are publications of the ASA. And they put out a call from the sections to have a piece on what COVID means to us. Well, COVID means everything to us, because it's a matter of animals and society, end of. But we were not invited to do that. And then I think recently, in the past couple of months, so that was a year ago, but Footnotes this year did a special issue on food justice. Conspicuously absent was anything to do with animals. And we weren't invited to participate in that at all. I didn't even see a call for papers on that. So it just seemed like we got brick walled a little bit there. So what does vegan sociology mean to you in the context of what makes us stand out from the rest of the community, I guess?
Well, in a sense, I suppose you could say that vegan sociologists are the purest form. Maybe it's the most evolved form.
Yeah.
Actually, that's one way to look at it.
Yeah. I like that. All right, well,
that's I can do.
I like that. No, that's good. I'm getting some really good buzzwords off of folks in the show. All right, well, I'll end it there, Bonnie. So thanks very, very, very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for listening to Sociology and Animals. I hope you found it helpful and informative. If you want to learn more about the sociological study of society and animals, you can check out the website of the Animals and Society section of the American Sociological Association, or my own website at coreylewren.com. You can also check out the International Association for Vegan Sociologists, and the website for that is vegansociology.com. Feedback and suggestions can be submitted to myself at coreyren@gmail.com. That's coreywrenn@gmail.com. If you liked this episode, be sure to share the series with others. The music for this podcast was provided by Ode to Sleep, a band local to where I live, here in East Kent, England. Ode to Sleep explores various topics with their music, including human and animal rights, environmental issues, equality, and mental health. Until next time, this is Dr. Corey Wren signing off. All the best.